7. The Libido for the Ugly. H.L. Mencken. On a winter day some years ago, coming out of Pittsburgh on one of the expresses of the Pennsylvania Railroad, I rolled eastward for an hour through the coal and steel towns of Westmoreland County. It was familiar ground. Boy and man, I'd been through it often before. But somehow, I had never quite sensed its appalling desolation. Here was the very heart of industrial America, the centre of its most lucrative and characteristic activity, the boast and pride of the richest and grandest nation ever seen on earth. And here was a scene so dreadfully hideous, so intolerably bleak and forlorn, that it reduced the whole aspiration of man to a macabre and depressing joke. Here was wealth beyond computation, almost beyond imagination. And here were human habitations so abominable that they were disgraced a race of alley cats. I am not speaking of mere filth. One expects steel towns to be dirty. What I allude to is the unbroken and agonizing ugliness, the sheer revolting monstrousness of every house in sight. From East Liberty to Greensburg, a distance of 25 miles, there was not one in sight from the train that did not insult and lacerate the eye. Some were so bad, and they were among the most pretentious, churches, stores, warehouses, and the like, that they were downright startling. One blinked before them as one blinks before a man with his face shot away. A few linger in memory, horrible even there. A crazy little church, just west of Jeannette, set like a dormer window on the side of a bare leprous hill, the headquarters of the veterans of foreign wars at another forlorn town. A steel stadium, like a huge rat trap somewhere further down the line. But most of all, I recall the general effect of hideousness without a break. There was not a single decent house within eye range, from the Pittsburgh to the Greensburg yards. There was not one that was not misshapen, and there was not one that was not shabby. The country itself is not uncomely, despite the grime of the endless mills. It is, in form, a narrow river valley with deep gullies running up into the hills. It is thickly settled, but not noticeably overcrowded. There is still plenty of room for building, even in the larger towns, and there are very few solid blocks. Nearly every house, big and little, has space on all four sides. Obviously, if there were architects of any professional sense or dignity in the region, they would have perfected a chalet to hug the hillsides. A chalet with a high-pitched roof to throw off the heavy winter snows, but still essentially a low and clinging building, wider than it was tall. But what have they done? They have taken as their model a brick set on end. This they have converted into a thing of dingy clapboards, with a narrow, low-pitched roof, and the whole they have set upon thin, preposterous brick piers. By the hundreds and thousands, these abominable houses cover the bare hillsides, like gravestones in some gigantic and decaying cemetery. On their deep sides, they are 3, 4, and even 5 stories high. On their low sides, they bury themselves swinishly in the mud. Not a fifth of them are perpendicular. They lean this way and that, hanging on to their bases precariously. And one and all, they are streaked in grime, with dead and eczematous patches of paint peeping through the streaks. Now and then, there is a house of brick. But what brick? When it is new, it is the colour of a fried egg. When it is taken on the patina of the mills, it is the colour of an egg, long past all hope or caring. Was it necessary to adopt that shocking colour? No more than it was necessary to set all the houses on end. Red brick, even in a steel town, ages with some dignity. Let it become downright black, and it is still sightly, especially if its trimmings are of white stone, with soot in the depths and the high spots washed by the rain. But in Westmoreland, They prefer that uremic yellow. And so they have the most loathsome towns and villages ever seen by mortal eye. I award this championship only after laborious research and incessant prayer. I have seen, I believe, all of the most unlovely towns of the world. They are all to be found in the United States. I have seen the mill towns of decomposing New England and the desert towns of Utah, Arizona, and Texas. I'm familiar with the back streets of Newark, Brooklyn, and Chicago, and have made scientific explorations to Camden, NJ, and Newport News, VA. Safe in a Pullman, I have whirled through the gloomy, godforsaken villages of Iowa and Kansas, and the malarious tidewater hamlets of Georgia. I've been to Bridgeport, Conn, and to Los Angeles, but nowhere on this earth, at home or abroad, have I seen anything to compare to the villages that huddle along the line of the Pennsylvania from the Pittsburgh Yards to Greensburg. They are incomparable in colour, and they are incomparable in design. It is as if some titanic and aberrant genius, uncompromisingly inimical to man, had devoted all the ingenuity of hell to the making of them. They show grotesqueries of ugliness that in retrospect become almost diabolical. One cannot imagine mere human beings concocting such dreadful things, and one can scarcely imagine human beings bearing life in them. Are they so frightful because the valley is full of foreigners, dull, incessant brutes with no love of beauty in them? Then why didn't these foreigners set up similar abominations in the countries that they came from? You will, in fact, find nothing of the sort in Europe, save perhaps in the more putrid parts of England. There is scarcely an ugly village on the whole continent. The peasants, however poor, somehow manage to make themselves graceful and charming habitations, even in Spain. But in the American village and small town, the pull is always toward ugliness, and in that Westmoreland valley, it has been yielded to with an eagerness bordering upon passion. It is incredible that mere ignorance should have achieved such masterpieces of horror. On certain levels of the American race, indeed, there seems to be a positive libido for the ugly, and on other and less Christian levels, there is a libido for the beautiful. It is impossible to put down the wallpaper that defaces the average American home of the lower middle class to mere inadvertence, or to the obscene humour of the manufacturers. Such ghastly designs, it must be obvious, give a genuine delight to a certain type of mind. They meet, in some unfathomable way, its obscure and unintelligible demands. The taste for them is as enigmatical and yet as common as the taste for dogmatic theology and the poetry of Edgar A. Guest. Thus, I suspect, though confessedly without knowing, that the vast majority of the honest folk of Westmoreland County, and especially the 100% Americans among them, actually admire the houses they live in and are proud of them. For the same money they could get vastly better ones, but they prefer what they've got. Certainly there was no pressure upon the veterans of foreign wars to choose the dreadful edifice that bears their banner. There are plenty of vacant buildings along the trackside, and some of them are appreciably better. They might indeed have built a better one of their own. But they chose that clapboarded horror with their eyes open, and having chosen it, they let it mellow into its present shocking depravity. They like it as it is. Beside it, the Parthenon would no doubt offend them. In precisely the same way, the authors of the Rat Trap Stadium that I've mentioned made a deliberate choice. After painfully designing and erecting it, they made it perfect in their own sight by putting a completely impossible penthouse painted a staring yellow on top of it. The effect is that of a fat woman with a black eye. It is that of a Presbyterian grinning. But they like it. Here is something that the psychologists have so far neglected. The love of ugliness for its own sake, the lust to make the world intolerable. Its habitat is the United States. out of the melting pot emerges a race which hates beauty as it hates truth. The etiology of this madness deserves a great deal more study than it has got. There must be causes behind it. It arises and flourishes in obedience to biological laws, and not as a mere act of God. What precisely are the terms of those laws, and why do they run stronger in America than elsewhere? Let some honest Privat Dozon in pathological sociology apply himself to the problem. From Reading for Rhetoric by Caroline Schroeds, Clifford A. Josephson, James R. Wilson.